And that phrase that Esme read at the end, as the barley harvest was beginning, is key for what happens next week. But this evening, we're thinking about chapter 1. And if you were here last week, you will, hopefully at least, remember that we thought about that opening phrase, in the days when the judges ruled. We thought about what life was like in that period, and we recognised that the author, as he wrote many years later, was able to look back on those events with the benefit of hindsight and the benefit of understanding what had happened, and to speak about the significance of those events in a way that wouldn't have been known to them at the time. And we thought about how that was similar to the way in which Luke introduces the story of the birth of Jesus. And we also thought about the stories that we might be involved in and the events that we are living through. And that even though we may not understand the significance of what's going on in our lives, that maybe God may be working out some big purpose. And we saw that one of the significant things that happened as a result of this story of Ruth, is that right at the end, we see that as a result of all of this, King David is born. And that all that is going on in this story leads up to that. And this evening what we'll see is that the events in the story in this first chapter suggest a crisis moment. A crisis that threatens the possibility of David even being born. We start with a bit more context. It wasn't just in the days when the judges ruled, but at a particular time. There was no food. There was famine in the land, we find in verse 1. We don't know the cause of the famine. We're not told. But I want to suggest that it's reasonable to assume that it wasn't just a natural event, that God was directly involved in causing this famine. And I want to suggest that because one of the warnings that God gave to his people if they were disobedient to him was that he would stop rain, which would cause famine. You find this in a couple of places earlier in the Bible. And in Leviticus chapter 26, for example, God says this. If after all this, God's already done some stuff. If after all this you will not listen to me, I will punish you for your sins 7 times over. I will break down your stubborn pride. I make the sky above you like iron and the ground beneath you like bronze. Your strength will be spent in vain because your soil will not yield its crops, nor will the trees of your land yield their fruits. And God is saying, one of the ways in which I'm going to try and draw you back to myself is to stop you having anything to eat. And here we see that the land is suffering in this way. And it extends to Bethlehem. And there is some probably intended irony in the use of the word Bethlehem here. Bethlehem means house of bread. But even that place is unable to provide food for those who live there. So it affects the land, it affects Bethlehem, and it affects a particular man, Elimelech, and his family. And so we've got this famine that affects the whole land, that affects the town, it affects the individuals. And it reminds us that in large disasters, and we hear about them all the time, we eventually get down to individuals and families who need help. I was reminded of this as I was driving down the M1 on Thursday to go and see a friend of mine in London and spend time with our son, Richard and Emma and Abby. And I was at junction 11 of the M1 going south. And I suddenly realised that on the northbound carriage, there was lots of people sitting on the side of the road, which you don't normally see. And there were about a dozen police cars and ambulances and about 6 miles of queuing traffic trying to go north. I was glad I was going south. And I found out later, it was some refugees who were being transported in a refrigerated lorry, and they were concerned that they were running out of air, and they escaped. and they were caught by the police and arrested and sent to hospital for those who needed treatment and so on. And we know that there's a big problem with refugees, but suddenly it was these few people who were what presented itself to me as the story. And each of those individuals is part of the refugee crisis that we see in this country. And at the end of the day, stories are about individuals. And this evening, we're going to look at four of the people in this story and see what it tells us about them. And as we do so, I'm going to ask you to think about which of these four people do you most closely associate yourself with? And ask yourself, are you okay with that? Or is there maybe something in this person which you see in yourself that you know you ought to change? Maybe we need to change our understanding of God. Maybe we need to change our engagement with God, how we relate to God. Maybe we need to change our commitment to God. You'll see these things as we look at these different characters. And we start with Elimelech. As the husband and the father in the household, he would have been recognised as the head of the household. It was a very patriarchal society. What the man of the house said went. He would take decisions for his family. And he's faced with a problem. The place where he was living is in a famine, and he isn't able to provide food for his family, which was one of his major responsibilities. And so he's faced with a choice. He could stay and hope that somehow he'll be able to find food for his family, or he could go somewhere else in the hope that he can find food there. Those seem to be his choices. But maybe he has another choice. Maybe he could look at the bigger picture and recognise that maybe God is bringing this punishment upon the people. And that he could turn to God and ask for forgiveness. If we carried on in that passage in Leviticus, after we see the different ways that God says he will punish his people for their disobedience, there is a promise that if they turn back to God and if they confess their sins, then he will forgive and restore. Elimelech is not responsible for the sins of all the people, but he's part of it. We saw last week of how the people were in this never-ending cycle of being more and more disobedient to God and turning against God and following wrong ways and God punishing them. And that's what's going on here. And there was an option for Elimelech as an individual, irrespective of everything else that was going on around him, to turn to God and to seek restoration and to seek God's blessing. But as far as we know, he doesn't pursue that option. He simply tries to come up with his own solution to the problem with little or no thought for God. And I wonder how much we act the same way in our lives. As we see the wickedness going on all around us, as we are affected by it, and sometimes maybe part of it, do we just look for our own solutions? Or are we people who are prepared to seriously engage with God, to ask for his forgiveness, to ask for his blessing? And not just on our own account, but on behalf of the people in our towns, in our country, in the world. Instead of taking that option, instead of turning to God, Elimelech decides to go with his family to neighbouring Moab. And Moab and Israel had a long history. And it wasn't a happy one. As the people of Israel escaped from Egypt and travelled to the Promised Land, the people of Moab tried to stop them. Tried to stop them getting to the place where God had promised that they would go. They tried to entice them away from following God. And they've been enemies fighting over territory for many, many years. And it was to this place of enemies, this place of foreign gods, that Elimelech decided to take his family. The prospect of food seemed to outweigh everything else. We're going to stop there for a moment, and I want us to think quietly about a question. the situation that Elimelech was in was hard. It was difficult. He wanted to provide for his family, and he came up with a solution. In situations we have faced this week, where we've maybe had to make difficult decisions, how have we gone about that? Have we focused on our own selves and trying to find our own solutions? Or have we taken time to reflect on whether God is trying to say something to us through those situations? Maybe whether God is expecting something of us, and that we've taken God's perspective into account as we try to think through what we have to do. Let's just be quiet for a few moments and think about that, and then we'll carry on and look at the story from the perspective of Naomi. The story gets worse. While they seem to have been accepted and presumably found something to eat in Moab, after some time Elimelech died and Naomi was left a widow, and the royal line that led to David was threatened. She takes on responsibility for her family. No longer are the two boys referred to as his sons, but they're now referred to as her sons. There's hope still there as her sons, as was expected, married. But they didn't have any children. And after a while, after about 10 years, they died. And so Naomi and her two daughters-in-law were left without any men to provide for them or protect them. A dangerous situation for women in those days in that context. But more significantly, in the light of the bigger picture, there was real danger to the royal line as no child had been born. And Naomi was concerned. She heard that God had acted in her home country and that food was available, and so decided to return home. She'd been away for a long time, but there was nothing left for her in Moab. She was a stranger, still a stranger in a foreign land. She wanted to go back to the people she knew. She wanted to go back to the village she called home. That was what was motivating her. But as we look back on the story with the benefit of an outside understanding, we see that God is working so that Naomi will come home to. Naomi will once again come home to a place where the royal line has a chance to be preserved. There's no hint of repentance in Naomi or in the wider Israel, but God is responding to them graciously. And so she sets off home. And Orpah and Ruth, they travel with her for the first part of the journey. It was Naomi's plan and expectation that they would go back to Moab and she would travel on to Bethlehem alone. Because she, as any mother-in-law in that context would have been, was concerned that her daughters would be able to remarry, to have children. She knows that will be easier in their own country. And so, without telling us anything about her own inner feelings, we hear that Naomi turns to the two younger women and encourages them to go back home and seek another husband. She knew that the world in which they lived, security and well-being, were directly dependent upon the link with some man. Widowhood meant inevitable alienation and destitution. It wasn't a good situation to be in. And so Naomi was caring for her daughters-in-law and saying, go back, find a nice man and marry him. But they seem to want to journey with her, to go with her to Bethlehem. And so she tries again, more forcefully. Don't go with me, go home. It's a sensible thing to do. What does this dialogue tell us about Naomi's faith? Her faith in God, her understanding of God. The first time Naomi refers to God, she's praying that he will show her two daughters-in-law kindness, because they were kind to their dead husbands and to her. And because of that, she prays that God will help them find new husbands and be blessed there. So, she's praying that God will bless these two younger women. But then in verse 13, as she reflects on what has happened in her life, she blames God for it all. As she says that the Lord's hand has turned against me. So the way in which she seems to be engaging with God is twofold. She wants God to be kind to her daughters-in-law, because they've been kind to her. But she blames God for the loss of her husband and sons. There is no hint that maybe the people of Israel would have blamed for the famine in the first place. No acknowledgement that maybe going to Moab would have been the wrong thing to do. But rather, she blames God for the bad things in her life, while asking him to be kind to the people that she likes. And as we read further in the story, we see this continuing. Verses 20 and 21. The Almighty has made my life very bitter. I went away full, but the Lord has brought me back empty. Presumably relating to the fact she went away with her husband and two sons and came back with none of them. She says, the Lord has afflicted me. The Lord has brought misfortune upon me. And how many times today do we hear people responding in that way? Why did God allow this to happen? Why did God take this person away from me? Oh, but I like these people, so God, please be kind to them. That seems to be the way Naomi was thinking about God. How many times do we react in that way? How many times do we see that in other people? Is it right? Is it appropriate? Is this a mature faith? Or maybe we should be recognising that other factors may be involved, that there is human sin to take into account. There are natural disasters. We do live in a broken and fallen world. And these are all things we should take into account. Naomi is bitter after all she's experienced. She even wants people not to call her by that name anymore. Naomi means pleasant. And she's thinking, that's no longer a name that's appropriate for me, because my life is no longer pleasant because God has turned against me. She blames God. What is our understanding of God? What is our expectation of God? Particularly when things are going hard. Do we turn against him? Do we blame him? Or do we maybe recognise that God is still there? That even though things are difficult, God is someone we can trust in. Travelling with Naomi, two daughters-in-law, Ruth and Orpah. And Orpah, she initially wanted to go back with Naomi to Bethlehem, but she's finally convinced by her mother's arguments. It does work sometimes. And agrees to go back to her own family, to her own gods. Not presented as a bad decision. It's the natural thing for her to do. And then she drops out of the story. We never hear about her again. We don't know what happened to her. We don't know whether Naomi's prayers for her are answered. But we do know, because she is gone, is that she isn't going to be the answer to the crisis looming over the royal line. And her actions also tend to show the courage and determination shown by Ruth as she resists all of Naomi's attempts to get her to go back to Moab. But for Ruth, the question in front of her was very real. She could see her sister-in-law going home. She knew the sort of life she would be living if she went with her. It would be home. It would be comfortable. It would be what she'd grown up to know. Or she could go with Naomi. She could commit herself to Naomi's family, land, people, gods, with only what she'd seen of Naomi's imperfect faith to guide her in making the decision. And the first words we hear where Ruth is speaking alone are powerful poetry as she commits herself to a new future. Where you go, I will go. Where you stay, I will stay. She says, my future is bound up with you, Naomi. My future is bound up with your people. My future is bound up with your God. The bond between them, according to Ruth, was going to be so strong that maybe not even death would separate them. She commits herself wholeheartedly to a future that she has no idea of what it's going to entail. The natural thing for a poor, destitute widow in that context would have been to cling to the familiar, to a home, her people, her gods. But she turns in the opposite direction and commits herself to a new adventure, to Naomi, to Naomi's people, and to Naomi's God. Her understanding of the God of Israel that she was committing the rest of her life to would have been very limited at that time. But out of love for Naomi, she was prepared to act on that small amount of faith and move forward into the unknown with her. Orpah did the sensible thing. She went home. Ruth took the step of faith, of hope, of I'm prepared to go into this future not even knowing what it means. And their lives, their destinies were very different. And so the two women continue on their journey, bound together until death do them part. They arrive, as I mentioned, as the barley harvest was beginning, a sign that God was once again blessing his people, and with the hope that the royal line was still intact. And we see next week how the story unfolds. But for now, at the end of this chapter, we see two women. Elimelech's gone, Mahlon, Chilion, Orpah are gone. So it's these two women. Naomi, after having suffered and lost much, feeling bitter and angry towards God. Ruth, with little understanding of God, but prepared to commit herself to him and to go and live among his people. As we've considered these four people, which, if any of them, do you see yourself like? Which character traits do you share with them? An Elimelech who seems to make key decisions without any real thought for God and is prepared to take his family into an alien place. An Orpah who eventually takes the easy option and goes home without facing up to the opportunities and challenges that have been presented to her. And Naomi who, feeling life has treated her badly, blames God and becomes bitter. A Ruth who is prepared to totally commit herself to God and to his people without knowing what that will mean. Luke tells a story of a man who came up to Jesus as he was walking along the road. And he was obviously attracted to who Jesus was and what Jesus was doing. And he said to Jesus, "I will follow you wherever you go." Jesus turned to him and says, "Foxes have holes and birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head." The Son of Man was how Jesus often referred to himself. And what Jesus is saying is that following me is not an easy option. It's not the option where you're certain of what's going to happen next. Jesus was saying that following him is a life where you didn't know where you would sleep that night, let alone what you'd be doing that day. And in the context of Jesus, that was very physically and practically true. His was a wandering ministry. He went from town to town, to village, to preach, to hit, to teach, to heal, to speak, to bless. And those who went with him, they didn't know from day to day what they'd be doing, where they were, where they'd be sleeping, and so on and so forth. And the call of Jesus on us today is different. It doesn't mean that we end up travelling around in a caravan not knowing where we're going to park or not knowing what we're going to do. But it does say that there are lots of unknowns about following Jesus. And are we prepared to say, in the light of that, I will follow you wherever you go? Luke doesn't tell us what decision this man took. Was he up for the challenge of what was involved in following Jesus? Did he say, "All right, if that's what it's like, I'm still going to be part of what you're doing. I'm going to follow you. And even if I don't know where I'm sleeping tonight, that's okay." Or did he say, "Well, I didn't really realise that's what it meant. So I'll just disappear into the crowd." We don't know. Was he up to the challenge, or did he, like Orpah, decide to take the easy option and go home? And for us, are we prepared for what it takes, what it means to follow Jesus in the way he calls us to? And that will be different for each one of us. Are we prepared to fully commit ourselves to him, whatever that may mean, even if we don't know what it will mean? Remember the story of Abraham, right at the beginning of God's encounter with Abraham. He comes up to him and says, "I want you to go. I want you to go to a land that I will show you where the land is," and that's it. That was the brief. And Abraham got up and went. Are we prepared to leave everything that is secure and familiar behind, just as Ruth was, so that we can be fully committed to following Jesus? Or are we going to allow things to hold us back? A friend of mine, I was at college with her, a great Christian leader, wrote in her journal some years ago that she felt God asking her a question. And the question God was asking her is, "Are you prepared to do anything for me?" And her response, she writes, was that one by one she went through all the potential things that could inhibit God's work in her life and chose to get rid of them. Her response to God's question was to say, "I will get rid of anything that would hold me back from following you." Because her desire was to wholeheartedly commit herself to God. That was something she wrote in her journal 10 years ago. And I know something of what that cost her. But when she was reflecting on that a few days ago, she said, "And I'm now in that position again where I have to think about whether I'm prepared to follow God. And this challenges me today," she says, "just as much as it did 10 years ago. But her commitment is still the same, to follow wherever God leads. And that's what we see in Ruth. That's the question that we see in this man who said, I want to follow Jesus. How are we going to respond when not Naomi, but Jesus calls us to follow?